Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And also by the Honda Fit. The all-new Honda Fit is small on the outside, yet roomy and versatile on the inside. Check it out at fit.honda.com. From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren. Coming up on this Friday edition of Film Spotting, our top five screen parents, plus listener feedback and music by Wilder Embry. But first, De Niro Scorsese, Wilder Lemon, Hawks Wayne, make room for Herzog Kinski, and really make room because Klaus Kinski might kill you if you don't. Our six-week Werner Herzog Klaus Kinski marathon kicks off with 1972's Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
Shot on location in Peru, the movie follows the mad 16th century journey of renegade Spanish conquistador Don Lope de Aguirre, played by Kinski, as he leads a splintered group of Francisco Pizarro's men in search of the mythical lost city of gold, El Dorado. Of course, El Dorado being the mythical lost city of gold, Aguirre's search is a fruitless, frustrating one, marred by mutiny, starvation, Indian attacks, and insanity. Sam, Francis Ford Coppola admits that Aguirre, with its, quote, incredible imagery, was a strong influence on Apocalypse Now. Apocalypse was released in 1979. Aguirre was released in Germany in 1972 with a U.S. theatrical release in 1977. And the two films are undeniably similar. Namely, both feature a trek down a river in a foreign, hostile land with characters who become increasingly unstable while isolated in nature. Are you willing to put Aguirre on the same pedestal that we and most film buffs put Apocalypse Now?
Well, you know, I can't say how excited I was about this marathon. I mean, I've been meaning to catch up with Herzog for years and years, and I just really never have. My only experience with him, really, admittedly, is the faux documentary, The Incident at Loch Ness, in which he's a star and a participant, and Grizzly Man, last year's great, great documentary. And, of course, Herzog's as well-known as a documentarian and as well-respected as a documentarian as he is as a fiction filmmaker. So I went into this film with a lot of excitement, and I have to admit, to answer your question, I wouldn't put it up on the pedestal of Apocalypse Now, largely because I think Herzog is fascinated, yes, by his environment, but he doesn't impose really a story, not nearly really as epic. I mean, the story itself is as epic as, you know, the arc of the story in Apocalypse Now, but it's like he becomes too fascinated really with everything else that's going on, like, you know, filming in the bowels of Machu Picchu in Peru on location with a bunch of actors. I couldn't ever quite forget, and I don't know if Herzog ever let me quite forget, that these actors were being put through hell on earth, which is sort of famous. Yeah. I mean, if Aguirre is famous certainly as a film, it is, but just as much it's as famous as many other Herzog shoots are for just being a demanding picture to film. You know, filming on location in the jungle for $500,000 with a camera he stole from the German Film Institute, one camera. And there are really, really powerful scenes in this movie. Absolutely. The opening scene among them. I mean, where really the single camera, really, it's this long, long take where we just are watching the characters, you know, descend Machu Picchu. You get a sense that the actors are unsafe or unsure of themselves. And there's this moment where the camera, you know, the shot goes on long enough where I was reminded immediately that these are actors who probably feel a little unsafe. Mm-hmm. But then I'm reminded too, it's like, these are the characters too. The characters themselves being, you know, completely out of their element would be just as out of their mind. So I think in terms of working with this idea of artifice and art and then reality, I think that kind of scene works. And there are other scenes that have a lot of power in terms of how they deal with nature. But overall, I wasn't really taken with the story, nor was I taken so much by Kinski's performance. I mean, okay, he's a magnetic personality, but the character itself.
Yeah, no, I definitely do see where you're coming from, though. Going back to that opening scene, you're right. It is breathtaking, them descending this Incan kind of trail, and it's a very long take, and it seems very boring after a little while, and you're wondering almost why you're seeing it. And then you realize that coming up out in the corner of the screen, there are people approaching the camera, and you felt this whole time like you're watching people at a distance, and you see this huge path of people, but then when you see how close they are to you, you realize even how much bigger the path of people is.
He really
is.
Captures the size of that place.
Yeah, it's really an amazing shot, and with just a little bit of subtle camera movement. And there are, I think, those kind of interesting visual surprises where things take you off guard throughout the film that I did really appreciate about it. Did I love it? Was I totally caught up in the story? Probably not. I think I was with you. But from a visual standpoint, and as someone who is fascinated by Herzog from, I'm with you. Grizzly Man may also be my only entry point into Herzog. And there are amazing similarities between that film and this one. You can't help but look at Aguirre and see him as this character who, just like Timothy Treadwell in Grizzly Man, gets isolated in nature and becomes completely unhinged and delusional, and starts to almost see himself as a god in a way, or at least starts to really lose sight of his mortality, of his humanity. Yeah. He sees himself as somehow otherworldly.
Right.
And you see that here. And I think when I mentioned Grizzly Man, it was on my top 10 films of the year, and I mentioned during our review of The New World that if I ever wanted two directors to get together and go bowling, it was Herzog and Terrence Malick, because they seem to have such a diametrically opposed view of nature.
Right.
And you see some of the same lyricism in the way this film is shot as you see in a film like The New World. But what you get in The New World, of course, is this lushness and this just admiration for nature and the beauty of it. And here you've got a guy in Herzog who, even back in 1972, clearly this isn't a complete evolution for him, what we see in Grizzly Man. Back in 1972, he had this view of nature constantly in opposition to man, malicious, conspiring against man. But what makes it even more tragic almost, or more harsh, is that he does juxtapose it with these great moments of beauty in nature. Mm-hmm. That opening shot, the river flowing before someone gets stuck in it and they can't get out and die. But before that, it's beautiful. And these moments of butterflies
coming down. But also
horrifying
in some way, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's like there's constantly this view of nature that is at once beautiful and then undercut by the horror of it. And I found that really fascinating.
I did too. But I think what you see, or what I saw in this film, is the struggle Herzog has between the filmmaker as storyteller and the filmmaker as documentarian. I just couldn't help. I was distracted by his fascination with his surroundings, and to the detriment, I think, of his characters and story.
Okay.
I mean, and there's almost like a, I don't know if you felt this, I was seeing it on a perfectly good sound system and entertainment system, but there was like a muttering quality to all of the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like he was afraid for it to appear too artificial, like too much like acting. And I feel like maybe just the fact that he's in the jungle, it needed, you have a larger than life presence in Kinski, yes, but I wasn't invested enough in his character. And really just the way Herzog directs his actors, they just seem to be, there is a kind of muttering quality.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the film, I mean, you go back, and I have to say, like, see the film, but really rent the film, and I insist that you watch the director's commentary. Herzog is a fascinating, fascinating individual, and the film has its pleasures, but the commentary is a pleasure all its own. In fact, if you don't have the time, just watch the commentary. Watch the film through the commentary, through the lens of the commentary. I really don't think you'll miss much, and Herzog is amazing. I mean, there's this opening sequence to the film which tells us the history. You know, that this is based on, like, this priest's lost writings or something like that. It's the only fragment. Completely made up.
Right.
You know, but also just his relationship with, you know, this famously tense relationship or fraught relationship with Kinski. I mean, with Kinski nearly murdering a couple people. And so it's wildly entertaining as a commentary and offers really true insight into the film as well. I mean, it's just a fascinating documentary.
Yeah, I've heard great things about it, and I didn't have time to get into the commentary, but I definitely plan to do it. And I did want to comment, I guess, on this kind of documentary quality to it. It's not a surprise that he is a documentary filmmaker, and you go back and watch this, and you see a lot of those touches, and maybe for you they were almost somewhat distracting, and that's what, for me, actually just made it more enjoyable to watch, was the way, especially in some of these early scenes, where he really does have these actors that are almost acting as slaves. They're slaves in the movie, and they have to literally lug a cannon through the mud and the rain and this forest, and it's not fun at all. It looks really horrific.
It does.
But there are moments where things are happening that look like Herzog actually used outtakes, and this happens throughout the film. Mm-hmm. There are moments that you really think for a second you're looking at them not as characters at all, and I think you're kind of hitting at this. But there are moments where literally you're watching it thinking, that wasn't a take. Like, that was just the camera rolling, and they got stuck in the mud, and he kept it, and he used it in the film. And there are these really interesting moments throughout the film where he has these long these long shots. Literally, the characters are, you know, it's a long shot. They're far away. You see their whole body. Maybe they're on a boat kind of sailing by. And he'll just kind of catch them, and then they'll notice the camera and glance at the camera or maybe smile, and it looks as if they're catching him, you know, in between takes.
Yeah, Kinski does that frequently, it seems, like he's looking, or he's taking on, he's having a dialogue with the camera in some way or with the audience. Yeah.
Yeah, there just always seems to be this interesting, this way he's capturing the characters that makes it seem like they're not acting at all, that they're actually kind of in the moment, but almost in between their character somehow and them as individuals. It's really bizarre, but I thought really fascinating. And I'm a little bit nervous only because I did like this movie quite a bit. And from what I read about it, everyone thinks this is their best collaboration.
This is the one.
Well, we've got five more films to see, including, you know, four really with them.
Yeah.
Of course, the last one, the documentary about their relationship, Herzog and Kinski.
Right.
But I'm really hoping that's not true, because as much as I did like it, I hope that this isn't the best. I hope we get to see some other great collaborations.
Its ambitions are limited in some way. In the commentary, Herzog says the greatest achievement of this film, as far as he's concerned, is that it exists at all. Not only that it was shot, but also that it survived. I feel like he's making something that, and this is, I really recommend anyone that's curious about Herzog to go back and see if they can track down this article that was written in The New Yorker a couple weeks ago about Herzog, but also about the filming of his new film that's starring Christian Bale and Steve Zahn. He's just, I mean, really as a way to see what his process is like. He's really just, he wants to experience, the title of the article is The Ecstatic Truth. And really you get a sense that that's what he's trying to capture. And so he's willing to put aside, in some ways, his role or his responsibility as a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And I totally respect that. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying in this film particularly, I felt like there was an imbalance between his true fascination, his talent at capturing nature, and the story that he was telling.
Well, I think part of it, too, is one thing I noticed early on is you have to ask yourself, whose story is this?
Right.
It's this pre-story. It's his narration from his diary we're hearing, and yet he's never really the main character. And yet Aguirre's never really the main character. And so you've always got these characters kind of subordinating themselves, and you don't really know who to follow here. So in terms of kind of a traditional narrative, it's not really at all.
It's
hard to grasp onto it and really figure out who you're supposed to follow here, whose story. And so that's something you see. But I will say that if you like Apocalypse Now, I think
you can't help
this.
But think of it.
I think you have to watch
as a predecessor, absolutely.
There's so many connections to it, really. And then also, if you are into Malick at all, I mentioned The New World, but if you're a fan of Badlands, which actually came before Aguirre, I believe, but Days of Heaven is later, and then The Thin Red Line, and then later with The New World, you're going to see all sorts of similarities, but an interesting dichotomy. I mean, really just putting these two filmmakers against each other is really fascinating and just fun to watch for that reason alone, or at least for me it was.
Agreed. No, I do agree. I just think the scene, we lacked one scene. If we just had one scene of somebody running out of the jungle saying, "Freaking tiger, man!" it would have been just elevated that much more.
It would have had the Sam Hallgren masterpiece label, 5 stars.
All right. Well, next week, the Herzog Kinski Marathon continues with Nosferatu, the Vampire. After the break, he's not a messiah, he's a very naughty boy. Your top 5 religious movies feedback is next. But first, some recent audio feedback.
Hey, Adam and Sam and Scott. This is Steve Wasser from the Gastrologica podcast. You left off my favorite religious movie, which is, in fact, one of my favorite cult movies of all time. First, it's a movie about your city. And second, they were on a mission from Gad. I'm talking about the Blues Brothers, of course. Endless quotable scenes and timeless music aside, the very plot rests on two wayward Catholics seeking divine inspiration and going through Herculean measures to save an orphanage. It doesn't get any more religious than that.
Hanging on to hanging on, feeding hope to what is gone, laughing off what should be lived and died for. Blacking out the blackouts, keeping calm when I should shout, paying dues with what has done run out. Let me see that picture once again, the one where I'm propped up on some friends, holding hands with my girl Lou. It helps me through, it helps me through. 'Cause I got a bad case of the nothing.
I have a very great friend in Rome called Bigus Dickus. Silence! What is all this insolence?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that, of course, a clip from Monty Python's The Life of Brian, and we will get into that in depth here as we get into the
major
mailbag.
Major oversight on your and Scott's
apparently
part.
Apparently a major oversight. We'll get into that during listener feedback here in a moment, but first we wanted to mention again the PeerFlix Show Us Your DVDs contest, because really the prizes for this are pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, in an effort to honor the truest DVD fans out there, PeerFlix is happy to announce the launch of the Show Us Your DVDs contest. PeerFlix is searching for the shrine that best symbolizes a passion for DVDs. Just provide a photograph of your collection and explain a bit about it. The grand prize is a 400 disc mega DVD changer and a free lifetime membership to PeerFlix. You do not need to be a PeerFlix member to enter. Learn more at blog.peerflix.com. That's blog.peerflix.com.
All right, enter yourself, Adam? I should enter. I wonder if I'm eligible, though. I don't have
a great shrine. I don't think I've seen it.
No, see, this is what happens when you have young kids who, as young children, like to come over and pull all your DVDs off
out
the
of
shelf.
Alphabetical order, so, or what are they in?
So
chronological?
Actually,
what?
They're in alphabetical.
Nice.
But my shrine is actually totally turned around, facing the wall.
Oh, God.
You can't see my shrine.
The hidden shrine.
My kids would pull all the DVDs off the
Kempinar code
shelf. So it's bad. It's bad. I'm not entering. one note, Aberdeen City, the band we played on episode number 100.
That's
they
right.
gave us a couple special exclusive performances. They're going to be back in Chicago playing at Shuba's on Thursday, June 8th. And I promised an appearance by Sam Hallgren, and yet you're telling me now it's not going
to
be so.
If there's a hip, you know, film spotting band playing in Hotlanta that same weekend, I will be there.
That's where you'll be.
Tell me where it is,
Thursday,
who's playing. Yeah, I'll be there.
Yeah, but unfortunately, once again,
keep avoiding these things.
Sam is way too good for our audience.
It's only because I don't exist.
Yeah. That's it. I'm planning on being at this show once again by my lonesome. No Sam there to meet his fans.
Hey, bring your pal Scott Smith.
Maybe I'll do that. I'll bring my guest.
It's
host
a spat.
Scott Smith.
I can feel a spat coming on.
I'm going to do it. Actually, now that you say it, I'll see if he's available.
Meet Scott Smith live in person.
That's right. So Thursday, June 8th, maybe myself and Scott Smith.
Yeah, that's right.
Sans Sam will be at the Aberdeen City show at Shuba's. I think it starts around 9 o'clock with them taking the stage a little later.
Right.
But again, I know it's for people out of town
We've seen them live and they're fantastic.
And they're very good. Yeah. Coming in on a Thursday night is probably not possible if you're coming from a distance. But if you're in the Chicago area, want to check out a great band, and we'll be there. We'll be happy to hang out. So go ahead and send us an email if you're interested in more details about meeting up. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. Sam, speaking of your fans, people know that you're a huge fan of this movie, Safe Men. You had Paul Giamatti and Sam Rockwell.
Yes.
Honorable mention.
Special honorable mention for the top comic performances of all time.
And we got an email. We got a couple emails, but this one
This one from TJ Wells in Plainfield, Illinois, giving us a very succinct message. Safe Men will be released on DVD at last on August 15th. I can stop lending out my VHS copy of Safe Men.
There you go.
And making the world believers that this movie is a very subtle, funny comedy.
Okay.
Very funny.
There you go. Safe Men is coming out August 15th. We also got a note from a listener who forwarded us an article by Scott Tobias in The Onion AV Club. Inventory 10 character actors who should be in every movie.
And I loved this idea before
I read a single name. All I am is pissed off that we didn't come up with it first.
I know, me too. This seems like something we
would have
come up with.
And I wonder if we could actually come up with maybe a better top 10. We've talked about some of the choices on here we really agree with, maybe some we're not huge fans of. And then, of course, our listeners out there can maybe share some of those as well. So, Sam, why don't you actually start? You do the 10 through 5, 10 through 6. I'll count down the 5 through 1. Just give the names that Scott Tobias put on here as 10 character actors who should be in every movie.
Yeah, 10 through 6. He's got 10. Robert Forster, of course, famous from Jackie Brown. We've got Rory Culkin. One of the Culkin kids, Timothy Oliphant, Scott Kahn.
Yeah, and Melissa Leo, you missed in there.
I missed Melissa Leo,
eight.
I'm sorry.
And at number 5, he's got Charlotte Rampling, of course, from The Verdict. Number 4, William Fichtner, everyone knows him from Black Hawk Down. He's in that. Exactly. And number 3, Zooey Deschanel, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and other movies. She's great.
The good
of course,
girl, yeah.
Almost Famous. And Nikki Catt, number 2.
This is the name that got me excited.
This is the best choice on here. Nikki Catt from Dazed and Confused. And of course, he's brilliant in The Limey and some other Soderbergh roles. And then number 1, Gary Cole from Office Space fame and others. So we like a number of those choices. We're not going to get improve. Into it right now, but maybe we can improve it. So with your help, send us your choices, 10 character actors. Give us a few that you want to see in every movie. Sam, you mentioned someone earlier. We're not going to say it, but someone who's an alum of the X-Men movies.
That's right.
Who should be.
That is not Ian McKellen, but should be in every movie. Yes.
I agree with you completely. Maybe some of our listeners can figure out who that is. So anyway, that's a fun little diversion that maybe we'll get into on a future show. Before we make the plunge into the mailbag, I wanted to share a story real quick, because we really haven't had much time here to reflect on the whole name change. And one of the things that we've been really overjoyed with is the fact that people seem to be big fans of the new name.
Embracing the name.
Despite all of the hoopla that was made about the terrible choices we were considering for the name, we seem to have landed on one film spotting. Yeah. And sure, there are a couple people that have said, oh, you know, it's too close to the movie Trainspotting, and I'm not a big fan of that movie, and why do you want to honor it? Whatever. And sure, there are a few of you out there like that. And
it works on so many more different levels.
I know, it does. Mm. And really, honestly, in all the hundreds of emails we've gotten about the name, literally, I can only count one. I'm talking to you, Jared from Boston, who actually hates the name. Yeah. Otherwise, most people seem to genuinely like it. Some people like it better than Cinecast.
Okay. I think I might be among those people.
Maybe so. So with that said, I just wanted to tell a little story that maybe ease everyone's fears about this name change
that
a little bit.
Fate may be involved.
Fate may be involved. Okay. So quickly, I'll just set this up. Sam, last July, we were kind of rolling with this whole podcast thing with iTunes hitting. We said, you know what? We need to form a company. So we're going to form a corporation. We had to pick a name. And I suggested Telegraph Road Productions.
That's right.
Because it's a name I've always liked, going back to the first time I ever took a trip with my college roommate from Grinnell College, Kevin Rich.
Very good friend of mine.
Very good friend of yours, too. At the time, you didn't know him.
That's right.
But back in college, our sophomore year, I went with him to his hometown, Oakville, Missouri, suburb of St. Louis, and I saw the sign, Telegraph Road. It's the road that takes you into Oakville, pretty much all the way to Kevin's house. And I just thought, that's a really cool, evocative name, Telegraph Road. And I loved hanging out in Oakville, met all sorts of great friends, friends that are yours now, friends that
that's
are
right.
mine,
that's right.
people we met that are friends of Kevin's. And so I suggested Telegraph Road, and the reason it worked additionally is because Kevin is the reason there's a film spotting.
That's right.
He introduced the two of us
that's right.
about 6 years ago. So you said, yep, perfect, Telegraph Road
Let's
works,
it.
That's it. So our company is Telegraph Road Productions. Film spotting rolls around. We decide to go with that. It is inspired, obviously, by the movie Trainspotting. We're not necessarily trying to say Trainspotting's the greatest movie ever made, but it's inspired by it. And I go on vacation. So a couple weeks ago, I'm on vacation in Mexico. I bring with me some movies to watch, and one of them is Trainspotting, because as I've admitted on the show, I don't know that I've ever sat down from start to finish and watched it. And I thought, well, you know what? If we're going to go with this name, I obviously have to make sure I've seen this movie. Right. As it turns out, I had seen every scene in this movie, but again, never from start to finish. So I'm watching the movie, and an hour in, you can go to the DVD, chapter 14, there's a scene where Ewan McGregor, Mark Renton, he is at his new job, and you hear him in voiceover talking all about his new job. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm just going to go ahead and play it for you. Here is a scene from Trainspotting, about an hour in, and here's what he has to say after the voiceover ends. See if it sounds familiar to you.
Profit, loss, margins, takeovers, lending, letting, subdividing. Cheating, scamming, fragmenting, breaking away.
Who's got the keys to Telegraph Road?
Amazing.
My jaw just hit the floor. And
I'm telling you, it's
I couldn't
fate.
Believe it. I mean, of all the roads in London that you could reference in that moment, he mentions Telegraph Road.
Yes.
The screenplay says Telegraph Road, the name of our company.
Yes.
So there you go.
In Trainspotting. I mean, come on, people.
Instantly.
So,
I knew
Jared from Boston?
Yeah.
I mean, it's you or the hand of fate. I mean, we're really going to go with the hand of fate.
Yeah, we're going with the hand of fate. We believe that it was all meant to be. And
for everyone that thought that we were just big Dire Straits fans, that really had nothing to do with it.
That is true.
Although Mark Knopfler also referring, I'm sure, to the Telegraph Road in London.
Maybe he is. Nicely done, Sam.
Thank
well
you so
played.
Much.
But so
full
anyway,
circle.
Yes, we just wanted to mention. I wanted to tell that story just to
it's
maybe
fun.
Put some of you
Amazing.
At ease. It really was shocking to me to see that, and it did make me think. You know what? This really was meant to be.
Yes.
So, let's get to a mistake we made, or at least Scott and I made. Not you, Sam. You
I wasn't
were exempt
involved.
From this. You weren't involved.
I haven't
in
made
this.
A mistake in months.
No, not in months. That's true. You heard the clip from The Life of Brian, and this was actually going back to all of our top fives. This was kind of one of the most overwhelming where. Mm-hmm. a number of listeners seem to have the same movie in mind. They were like, how could you have left it off? And let's go ahead and read this one from Michael in Germany. Did I miss something, or did you really leave off The Life of Brian? Ever since I watched The Life of Brian in music class in school, I can't take those epic Bible movies serious anymore. I want to go to Germany and go to take yeah. music class where you yeah. watch The Life of Brian. How great is
right,
that?
That's good.
We also got this one from John Golden in Longmeadow, Massachusetts. I must say that I was surprised in your last episode segment, the top five religious movies, that you never mentioned Monty Python's Life of Brian. It's not because I am particularly crazy about the film. In fact, I think it is the least funny of the three Python films. But many others, including John Cleese, think it's the greatest thing they have ever done and the most superb satire of organized religion to ever hit the screens. I would just like to know how it missed your list.
And
okay, well,
how?
I told Scott these emails were coming in. He was like, he instantly felt like an idiot for leaving it off. And my excuse was I watched it back in college and just really, I think I'd maybe had a few beers and it was late at night. And I don't know that I finished it, quite honestly. So because of the overwhelming responses, I went back and watched it this weekend. I watched the entire film. And as you know, Sam, I'm not necessarily a huge Monty Python guy.
In fact, your number one overrated movie of all time is...
You wanted me to get the hate mail, didn't you?
Is
the Holy Grail
of all time.
Which, again, I want to just say for the record, I like the movie.
Right.
I just don't
overrated.
Think it's as hilarious as everyone else does.
That's right.
So I'm watching The Life of Brian, and for a while, it is... just like what I expect from a Monty yeah. Python movie. It's amusing, but it's not really funny. I get to the scene where he writes Romans Go Home on the wall, and John Cleese does the whole Latin thing with him, makes him explicate it out and
right.
write it the right way. And that cracked me up, partly because I had to take Latin in college, or I did take Latin my senior year. So, of course, that was kind of amusing. And then I got to the scene that we just played in that clip, the biggest dickest scene with Michael Palin yeah. as Pontius Pilate. And I was laughing so hard, I almost peed my pants. I'm serious. That's how funny it was
funny
to me
movie.
At the time.
Yeah.
So I'm with you. I feel bad. But you know what? Honestly, it still wouldn't have made my top five.
All right.
Just because as good as it is, I just don't think of it kind of... I just don't put it up there with some of the others that I had on my list.
But so. I think it's like you said, it's like for people that aren't, you know, going through the list of movies that they've seen, you know, it's the first movie that popped into their mind.
Yeah.
Movies about religion. Well, Life of Brian.
Life of Brian.
And, you know, when you go back and look at all the films, maybe it wouldn't have made your list either necessarily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But.
That's a good point.
All right. Well, this email is from David Caldwell, writes, he gives his top five movies about religion. He has Mel Gibson's Passion of Christ, as did several, actually. A well-made film that is one of the very few mainstream films to take a ton from the story of Christ from a personal view familiar to a large portion of the Christian population. Number four, The Exorcist. Number three, he has Monty Python's Life of Brian. Number two, The Original Superman. Kind of a stretch, but I have always seen Superman, the only son sent by his father to Earth to redeem mankind as traffic in obvious Christian themes.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, sold. And number one, Kubrick's 2001. Whenever I try and discuss this film with friends, I always catch flack for trying to peg this as a profoundly religious film, even though Kubrick himself said that it was.
I don't think really you should get much argument at all. It certainly is.
Yeah. And Arthur C. Clarke, that was their sort
yeah,
of attention.
I mean, at least if you get back to this idea of this kind of quest for meaning. I mean, that's, again, kind of how I pinpoint religion, and certainly you have that in 2001.
And Kubrick, on the record, too, I love that what he tried to make was a film that was confounding, in a way, and it truly is.
Yeah,
but
it
was like, it was, in, you know, that he made a film. He and Clark made a film that had that intention, really, to make you wonder. And
mm-hmm.
that's, I mean, God, success.
Yeah, definitely so. And he mentioned The Exorcist as his number four. I just want to say another popular entry in a film that has been in top fives of mine. I love The Exorcist, and it was really a tough omission for me, a really great film. This one from Jason Garrett's interesting because he says, as a film professor at a Christian university, and we got so many of these people who
I'd say five or six
are pastors or who are professors or who have been
divinity,
to seminary, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's really great to get some of this feedback. Number five, Signs. Okay, so this is somewhat of a guilty pleasure as far as religious movies go, but I love how M. Night purposely manipulates you with an alien story to give us a faith message. Number four, Breaking the Waves. Number three, Dogville, Lars von Trier here.
Yeah.
Number two, Babette's Feast. This film is flawless and shares a simple message about the beauty of life's simple pleasures. And number one, Ordet. I'd encourage you to get the Criterion version as soon as possible, and I think we will have to do that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Dreyer showed up on another, several other lists, actually, with Passion of
Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
Of course. And I want to say that Signs, actually, a movie that I don't think is terrible. I think as an M. Night movie, it works fairly well.
Praise indeed.
Yeah, but Breaking the Waves, another tough omission for me. A great film.
All right, this one is from Ken Nussbaum, who gives his top five. He has Bruce Almighty on here for two reasons.
Yeah.
Morgan Freeman as God explaining why he couldn't make everyone just love him, and the disastrous results of thousands of people getting their prayers actually answered at the same time. So any movie that provokes a kind of thought.
Sure.
Like that. I guess that deserves credit. Number four, Ben-Hur. He has saved on here, the Massacre Theater from last week. Number two, The Matrix. It's old hat in some Christian circles, but The Matrix, and really The Animatrix 2, the only two that count, had several great things to say about destiny, faith, belief. It wasn't a perfect film, far from it, but it actually got enough right to be this high on the list. And number one, Beckett. It's an old film starring Peter O'Toole and Richard Burton as King Henry II and Thomas Beckett, respectively. And
I haven't seen, but fantastic actors, would love to see it. This one, the last one here, from Matt in Huntington, New York, and he's an associate pastor at a church and a guy with a degree in film, so he had to send in his top five religious films. And he wants to note
obligated
here. He does want to note, though, if any of his students are listening,
that's right,
that he isn't necessarily endorsing all of these films, their views.
Or condoning their content.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. But he does like how they explore the issue of faith. Number five, Black Robe, which I actually read in a history class in college and watched the film.
Yeah.
Number four, The Making of and God Spoke, a highly underrated mockumentary about the making of a laughable bad religious epic. Number three, The Passion of the Christ. Number two, The Ten Commandments. You guys covered it, enough said. And number one, The Passion of Joan of Arc. So great choices there. He also has honorable mentions, Frailty, which we've talked about a little bit on the
yes.
show. You didn't like. I sort of liked some things about it. Dogma and Defending Your Life, a fun Albert Brooks
movie. Yeah, I like that movie a lot. I think that may have made my top 10.
Well, if you've got feedback for us, send us an email or short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net.
We're going to take another quick break. Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me, aren't you? Our top five screen parents countdown is next. Back in a moment.
You give me all of the reasons that I should give all my wants to use the passing seasons. What goes off turns back on. To lay what I got before you. It might be enough to say what I got for you. Gives in and never gives up. And so soft the lights go down, and I feel you sneaking a warm glow in my heart. I'm not about to say one word now. Light me up in the dark.
Of course, it's much more based, as it says right up front, that it's much more based on the Kazantzakis novel than it is the actual Gospels.
Right.
But if you are familiar with the Gospels, and I am, welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm the biblical scholar, Adam Kempinar.
Nice, and I am. Wow, way to get out there.
Yeah, Scott emailed me after the fact, and he was like, my favorite line in the whole show is that apparently if you've taken two New Testament classes in college, you're an expert on the Christian scriptures.
Everybody else in the world.
Yeah, I apologize for that. But a nice segue, you know, into our top five for this week. We're going to get into our screen parents.
Because I'd never heard of them
until
I listened to the show. These
weren't
Gospels.
Familiar. At all.
Online Googled them.
Well, I'm glad I can elucidate you, Sam. That's what I'm here for. We'll get into our screen parents here in a moment. But first, tying in with the religious movies, as we mentioned on Wednesday's show, record-setting number of entries for Massacre Theater. Of course, a big part of that probably was the fact that we picked a scene that was in the trailer of the movie.
Nice.
Several people actually admitted, I haven't even seen the movie, but I knew the line. So I just wanted to acknowledge several of you wrote in and said, nice job, you picked such an obvious scene. But you know what? It really was just a matter of, I told Scott, I was like, look, I have to be Mandy Moore. I just have to say I'm filled with Christ's love. And I don't think anyone can begrudge me that.
No, nor can they a year from now when I pick a scene, one of my favorite scenes from American Dreams with Mandy Moore.
Oh, nice. You'll do it too, won't you? one other quick note. I just wanted to mention, going back to the train spotting and the film spotting kind of story I told there, Alex in New York City was a listener who wrote in and mentioned that, you know, some people are bemoaning the fact that we've lost maybe the Cinecrack.
Sure.
And we say, hey, you know what? We're not Cinecast anymore. We're Film Spotting. But, you know, it references train spotting. It's still about drugs. You want to call a Cinecrack, please go ahead.
That's fine.
But Alex mentioned maybe to be consistent, heroin, you can call a Cinesmack.
That's right. Yeah,
so,
if you're a literalist,
we'll just throw that out there. Feel free to consider yourself a Cinesmack addict. And with that said, we're now on to this week's top five. screen parents, tying in with X-Men 3, The Last Stand. There is a little bit of a connection there, but also this was a suggestion from a listener who said, you know, we're right in between here, Mother's Day here in the States, right, and then Father's Day coming up. Nice time to maybe look at some interesting movie parents. And Sam, your 6 through 10, I'll just mention the movie titles here. You had Tokyo Story, Midnight Run, and A Tie with True Romance, Raising Victor Vargas, Boys in the Hood, and another tie, You're Such a Cheater.
I know.
Spellbound, tied with Capturing the Freedmen. So, you're number five.
Very clever on my part, number five. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? George and Martha, whose son never appears. And the fact is, maybe the son of George and Martha, played by Richard Burton, of course, Elizabeth Taylor, may not exist. And Elizabeth Taylor was on my list of, or I think an honorary list, maybe, of top performances, female dramatic performances. Burton's amazing in this too. George Segal's in it, and he's fantastic. And the movie is just incredible. And so these are, if they were to be parents, these would be absolutely the most caustic and awful parents on film. Just the fact that the way they use the son, the missing son, the absent son, in the course of this evening is really sort of integral to the whole thing.
Great choice.
All right, so your 6 through 10, very quickly, the films Raising a Tie, Raising a sort of a nostalgia choice here, Raising Arizona and Mr. Mom, and then you had the others, the Limey, Royal Tenenbaums, and The Squid and the Whale.
All right, my number five, Sam, I'm expecting to take some heat for, at least from one of our listeners who likes to rip on us for bringing up this movie, but I went back to the top five list, Sam, on the filmspotting.net
site. No penalty box yet.
Not yet. Because we have not actually mentioned this film in a top five since Cinecast number 30.
Wow.
So I feel comfortable bringing it up again. And I'm actually putting as my number five screen parent, Beatrix Kiddo, Uma Thurman, from Kill Bill Volume 2.
Nice.
And I know it may seem like a little bit of an odd choice, kind of like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? You know, the daughter doesn't appear until the very end of the film in this one. It is mostly a revenge tale. That's how you think of Kill Bill. But I just caught the last hour of this when I was in Mexico, actually, on TV. And I was just reminded about how much I do like this movie and how great Volume 2 is. The scene where she discovers she's pregnant, first of all, is brilliant. I love that scene. And then where she meets her daughter, where she actually discovers that her daughter, who she is presumed to be dead, is still alive, just genuinely moving. And I don't know, I know you've kind of always been a little bit hard on Uma Thurman, but in this role,
she's amazing.
In these moments, she's amazing.
I mean, totally agree.
The moment where she meets her daughter for the first time and sees her is jaw-droppingly good.
Yep.
It's so fantastic, and she's fantastic as the bride in general, but I had to put it on there just for those moments. They're so moving.
Yeah, Kill Bill is to Uma Thurman as P.S. is to Laura Linney. I mean, she's
well played.
She's so much better than she is in anything else, I think. I think she's fantastic in it. Good choice. My number four, another pairing, Rushmore and Ghost World. I love Seymour Cassell as Bert Fisher, Max Fisher's dad, in Rushmore. It's where this film kind of slows down, and he's such an endearing presence. And just the fact that Max Fisher can have a dad like this, and you see their relationship was a really loving relationship, really makes you put up with Max the rest of the film when he's just an annoying kind of brat. I mean, or he's, you know, he's just very eccentric. And sort of secondarily, but also really nice, is Bob Balaban as Thor Birch's father in Ghost World. Again, we're sort of kind of a clueless dad of these very eccentric, kind of angry, you know, in the Thora Birch's character, really angry young woman. But, you know, Balaban, like, offering her a bagel in the morning, and just their relationship is really wonderful in a parallel way.
No, great pairing there. My number four is one that David Williams might not agree of, our friend in New York who mentioned that Ron Howard makes mediocre films. I think this one was Mediocre Boxer, but as film spotting listeners remember, we did both very much like Cinderella Man, and I've got Russell Crowe as James Braddock on my list. Again, say what you want about Ron Howard. The scenes of poverty in this film, I think, are devastating and handled really well. Yes, there are some scenes that go too far, but for the most part, I think they're really well handled. This family struggling that you see here, the struggle is really intense. And the scene where, of course, the memorable scene where he has to go beg for money in order to keep his family together. That's really the whole point. His mission here is to keep his family together. It's one of those movies that, as our friend the sports guy, Bill Simmons, likes to say, when you watch it, it gets a little dusty. For Sam, it's like hay fever season. you actually start.
You just made that pick to make me cry. You wanted to will me to cry.
I did. If I didn't make you cry by the end of it, then I didn't do a good explanation there, basically. Exactly. But those scenes are really those scenes really have a big impact. And you know, you think of great dads. I mean, this guy's willing to do anything to keep his family healthy and actually alive, and then together.
Yeah, I consider it myself. And Renee Zellweger, let's give her props.
You're,
great mom.
You're right. I felt bad about that because she is a good mom, and yet I'm focusing on him. But
My number three, a kind of pairing, but really it's an original and a remake, and it's Beat That My Heart Skipped and Fingers, a film, Beat That My Heart Skipped, a French film that came out last year, a remake of James Toback's Fingers. The dads in this are both particularly good, but particularly Michael Gatzo in the original Fingers is amazing. But Niels Arstrup as Robert Sayre, father of Romain Duris's Thomas Sayre in Beat That My Heart Skipped. I mean, Beat That My Heart Skipped, a better film, maybe the better performance of the dad, Michael Gatzo, also from A Godfather 2, of course, is just brilliant in this film.
Well, again, if you haven't caught on or you didn't get a chance to listen to Wednesday's show, clearly we are going with choices. These aren't necessarily the parents you would necessarily like to have.
That's right.
But really interesting parents, and of course are in films that deal with parenting.
I'll take Seymour Cassell as a dad.
You would?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah? Okay. Well, Barbara? My number three, Sam, this actually appeared on your 6 through 10, and that is Furious Styles, nice. Lawrence Fishburne from Boys in the Hood. There's that integrity about him and his intelligence, but there's, of course, that fierceness that Lawrence Fishburne brings where he's a guy you just do not want to piss off. And, of course, the great moment where he's with the cop after they've had their house broken into, and he says, something wrong? And he says, something wrong? Yeah, it's just too bad you don't know what it is, brother. And it's awesome. And, you know, I mean, again, he's a little preachy, of course. It's a John Singleton film. You're going to get a few of those didactic moments. But he's in some ways, he seems to be the perfect dad.
Yep.
In many ways, he's like tough, but he loves you, and he's going to guide you and show you the way.
Yep.
So,
no, it's a great pick. And it's like, when I saw, you know, Boys in the Hood, I mean, what, 89? Talk about, you know, character actors you want in every movie. Lawrence Fishburne in every single movie.
You can call him Larry.
I'll call him Larry. Okay. He used to go by Larry. Circa Apocalypse Now. Oh, Larry Fishburne. All right, my number two, you mentioned him, Jeff Daniels as Bernard Berkman in Squid and the Whale. I mean, we've had a few opportunities to talk about this. In fact, I think it was on my list of movie marriages. I think it tied in actually with Squid and the Whale at the time.
I put
it on the list. And it's just a transcendent performance. I mean, it's where I remember listening to an interview with Noah Baumbach, you know, who imagined the role differently. Like when they do read-throughs, you know, basing it after his own dad would play the role. And then he, you know, watching Jeff Daniels perform it the first time, he was like, no, that's actually how it should be performed. I mean, it really is something.
Yeah, he is incredible as this dad that just doesn't really have a clue how to raise a kid and is sort of trying to raise him as this intellectual, as this replica of himself. It's really a fascinating performance. My number two, I do have a pairing here. I decided to include the mom this time.
Nice.
Calvin and Beth Jarrett, Mary Tyler Moore, Donald Sutherland from Ordinary People, one of the great family dramas you think of course. And these are both just really amazing, great performances and two complex characters. Just when you think you have one of them pegged a certain way, they do something to subvert your expectations. And you do have to some extent, I think, just finally accept that Beth, Mary Tyler Moore, is a bad mother. She really actually did have a favorite son, and she doesn't know at all how to deal with Conrad or to show love to him. But at the same time, there are these moments of vulnerability that come through in her performance that are really fun to watch. And the scene where Calvin, where Donald Sutherland, such a great actor, where he finally expresses himself, where he finally talks to her and tells her what he's been witnessing this whole time, is really hard to watch, actually. I mean, really, really a moving scene. And when I think of course, any kind of family drama, Ordinary People comes to the top of the list. So
I wish I had made a bet with myself. I knew Ordinary People was going to be on there. And I almost had Donald Sutherland, honestly, from Pride and Prejudice. I liked both parents, the performances of both parents in Pride and Prejudice. But moving on to my number one, Mary Tyler Moore is included in this, but it's a sea of parenting, actually. A favorite of mine, Flirting with Disaster. Mary Tyler Moore and George Segal as Pearl and Ed Koplin. Then you've got Lily Tomlin and Alan Alda as Mary and Richard Schlichting, or Shit King, depending on how you'd like to pronounce it. Then Celia Weston as Valerie Sweeney. And then David Patrick Luther in The Warriors, Kelly, as Fritz Boudreau. False parents.
Uh-huh.
But this movie is all about choosing a parent. Who do you want to be your parent? Do you know, leave behind the adoptive parents, the sort of over preening, you know, Jewish family, or the hippies, LSD, you know, makers out in Arizona. I mean, and it's, but it's just a lot of fun. I mean, you just get the sheer number of parenting options in this film. And it's a wonderful film.
It is a wonderful film. Very funny. My number one, someone who may be the most evil, conniving, one of the most evil, conniving characters ever put on celluloid. And I know that actually back when we did our top five villains list, her name came up a lot, and that's Mrs. Eleanor Islin, Angela Lansbury in The Manchurian Candidate. Yeah. And I think Meryl Streep is very good, too, in the recent update, the Jonathan Demme film. This is a role Lansbury was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. She did not win. But you really do get the sense watching it that she genuinely loves her son, but is also completely willing to use him in any way imaginable, really unthinkable ways, to suit her needs. And that, I think, again, we talk about the mother-son relationship. This is a really bizarre, really fractured psychological one, and she's just brilliant to watch in that film. I mean, she is evil, and yet Lansbury never goes over the top with it. She never, maybe in a way that Streep does a little bit, maybe perform a little too much. I never felt Lansbury was too theatrical. I think she's great. So
there you go. Smack in between Mother's Day and Father's Day, and here we are praising some of the worst parents
ever
for committed to film. Oh, well. Happy Mother's Day, Mom, and happy Father's Day, Dad.
Exactly.
That is our top five, and that is our show. Please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting.
Opening in wide release this weekend, actually just The Breakup with Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston. And Sam, we will review this next week and reveal our top five chick flicks.
Yes.
And we should explain that we don't really mean it necessarily as the conventional kind of romantic comedy that's the movie that guys hate to be dragged to,
right,
usually by definition, but we mean movies about women. Really, these are movies for the girls.
Right. So okay, that's why we love and respect them so much, we're going to call them chicks.
Yes, we're going to be derogatory. But hey, it rhymes so well, Sam.
I know.
Okay? I can't help it. So I have chick in apostrophes.
You do. It's noted here.
It's noted here. Yeah. Chick flicks.
And, you know, we all know apostrophe means, you know, derogatory, winkingly, ironic.
That's it.
That's right.
Thanks to Wilder Embry for today's music. Please check him out on the web at wilderembry.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Holgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Swap the DVDs you have for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And also by Honda Fit. The all-new Honda Fit is small on the outside, yet roomy and versatile on the inside. A VTEC engine, anti-lock braking system, and front side and side curtain airbags are standard. And for added style, there's the Fit Sport Automatic with rear roofline spoiler and wheel-mounted paddle shifters. The Honda Fit is set and ready to go. Check it out at fit.honda.com.